spent my adult life studying it. So why have I spent my adult life dedicated to studying and practicing? I guess there's a number of reasons. The first, obviously, and the primary one is that it works. And not only anecdotally in my own life has it helped me work with and be able to be at ease with everything from obsessive mental ideations that my brain is very capable of, and the ambient stresses that arise during the day, and the I had some pretty paralyzing panic attacks in my earlier life, and all of these and so much more difficult events in the mind and body I've been able to work with thanks to Buddhist practice, and the clinical documentation is pretty overwhelming in the effectivity in dealing with everything from OCD to panic attacks to suicidal ideations all across the board to just your commonplace neurosis. Mindfulness and meditation is incredibly powerful. It also has many, many health benefits. A second reason I really was drawn to it is because the Buddha did not proselytize. He openly challenged his people who came to hear him not to believe anything he said and to see for themselves that this path worked, and if it didn't work, to not follow it. And he discouraged any form of proselytizing. And in fact, when members of the Jains and the Brahmins came to talk with him, he discouraged them from leaving their faith. And he gave some really very even-handed accounts of other spiritual practices of his day in the Digha Nikaya. And he also, on his journey to enlightenment, he studied with the great Hindu yogic masters of his day and was very close with them. So this is not about rejecting any other spiritual path, nor is it about knocking on doors or going around to your friends or my friends and trying to convince them of the way. So another thing I liked is that there's no God in Buddhism. It's not a theistic belief. Not to say that the Buddha didn't have, there weren't gods mentioned occasionally in the teachings, but the Buddhist belief is not that God plays a role in our lasting happiness. That comes from our spiritual practice, working within. You can believe in God if you want or not. It doesn't, it has no issue in Buddhist practice. The point of Buddhist practice is to develop tools to end our stress and suffering that we can use. So I was really attracted to that as well. But tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about another part of the Buddhist teachings which are very important to me, which are the Paticca-samuppada, or the Buddha's very detailed and clinically accurate analysis of the way the mind works in creating stress and suffering on a moment-by-moment basis. Generally, to summarize what he teaches in it, because it's a little complex, and I'm not going to go over each step of it. There are 12. But it's very central to the Buddhist teachings, and yet a lot of teachers shy away from it because they think it's unwieldy. In general, the teaching simply states that the human mind is conditioned to constantly try to solve every discomfort that arises externally. We always go out into the world trying to fix stress, which arises inside of the body, inside of the mind. And that rather than looking inwards and trying to work with whatever arises and be at ease with it, we constantly go out into the world and try to change the things around us. So that the idea is the human, whenever we feel, for instance, of course, cold, we look for something warm to put on. When we feel hunger, we look for something to eat. Thirst, we immediately look for something to drink. And there's nothing particularly wrong with that. But then from this very basic model, whenever we feel any underlying discomfort or stress, we try to make whatever is going on externally go away so that we internally won't feel uncomfortable. To be a little bit more precise, the teaching goes like this. The Buddha said we have this, what I talked about, this underlying sense of that every solution is an external solution. And this is avijja. This is the sort of root training or default of the mind. And what happens is when we make contact with any stimuli, which is fasa, contact, what happens is, and this stimuli can be a look on somebody's face, it could be a perception of the weather or how what's going on around us, it could be a state of the environment, or it could be something internal, it could be a pain, it could be a memory. And then what happens from that is the next stage is we develop gut feeling, what the Buddha called Vedana, which is a basic, felt, immediate, largely unconscious reaction to what's going on around us, to what we're experiencing. The Buddha said there's three kinds. There's positive dukkha, I like what I'm experiencing right now, I like what's going on, I like this person, I like this conversation, I like this food or whatever. And that's known as sukha vedana. And then there's negative. I don't like what's going on. I find this frightening. This reminds me of something I don't like. I'm not happy right now. And that's dukkha vedana. And then there's the third, which is neither dukkha nor sukha vedana. And it's simply, I don't have any opinion. Neutral vedana. Sometimes referred to as upeka vedana. So anyway, there's three ways we can respond, positive, negative, or have no response to what's going on around us. And then from this felt physical somatic experience that's registered in the body, we add on top of it thoughts, trying to explain why do I feel this way and what can I do to, if I'm liking what's going on, what can I do to keep the external conditions going, so that I can still feel happy. Or if we feel discomfort, the thoughts become, what can I change to make this feeling go away? So there's this movement from somatic feelings in the body that react to stimuli to going out into the world. Now, so thoughts, our thoughts, in a word, are the mind's attempt to explain what's going on in the body. That's what a lot of our thinking is. We like to think that our thinking is objective, you know, observations of the world and what's going on, but a lot of the time, it's not about the world, it's about trying to explain the fact, I'm feeling uncomfortable right now, there's got to be something wrong with this person I'm talking with, this event, whatever. And so rather than making objective or unbiased responses to stimuli, we're actually being driven by something that's unconscious that we don't even realize. To give you an example of how this works, suppose there was a sweater that your dad wore when you were young, and when he wore that sweater, he yelled at you one day, and it was very frightening. Then, as an adult, you see somebody wearing the same or a similar sweater. What happens is this triggers this underlying physical state of discomfort in the body. And then the mind goes, oh, I don't like what's going on. It must be this person's fault. There's something wrong with them. And then we try to find what we don't like about that person. Of course, we'll never get to the truth, which is that he's wearing a sweater that reminds us of our father. Oftentimes what's going on is the mind creates or fabricates a reason why we're experiencing or feeling this way. To give you an example, the great neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux did this experiment where he would show one abstract figure, kind of a, you know, abstract drawing to people. He'd do it very fast, subliminally fast, so they wouldn't realize that they had seen this abstract image. And then he would lay out before them five abstract images, one of which was the exact same image that they had been flashed in, that had been flashed before them. So one of them they had seen before, although they had only seen it unconsciously. When he would ask which of the abstract images they liked the most, they would always point to the one that they had been shown incredibly quickly, the subliminally one. And then he'd ask, well, why do you like that one? And they'd come up with these long-winded explanations. Oh, it's symmetrical, I like the line weight, I think that it reminds me of Maine, whatever. Never once would they come up with the real answer, which is that, oh, subliminally quickly, I'd seen that image before. Another experiment that was done is they would show people images of people, one a person with a smiling face, one with a neutral face, and one with a frowning, discouraging face. Then later on, they would show the same people with neutral expressions. And the ones that people would negatively respond to always was the face that they had seen before but had forgotten, that had the negative expression. We tend to encode in the brain primarily negative experiences, fear-driven experiences. Secondarily, much less, we encode really positive. But generally, the whole underlying memory system of the brain is towards bad experiences, fear, things that threaten our survival, things that when we were young as children were disturbing to us and made us felt unloved and unsupported and unacknowledged and protected. Anything that goes on then, it could be a color we see or a facial expression or a place later on in life, these same stimuli will trigger underlying physical stress and then we'll try to change what's going on around us, not realizing why we are trying to undo what's going on. To read a really very simple explanation of it, I'd like to quote from the world's greatest living neurologist, a guy named Antonio Damasio. He said that feelings are a lasting memory of an emotional response from the past. Based on previous experiences, we react automatically to present stimuli if it is similar enough to the original traumatic event. So in other words, we see something now that reminds us of a trauma from earlier in life, and we don't like it. We want it to go away. This reaction doesn't require thinking. Our emotional responses are preconscious and thus precede all thoughts. In fact, they are the foundation for thought. Bodily behavior, positive or negative, leads to the creation of our impulses and ideas. Feelings help us solve the problems of our day-to-day life. This is actually a summary of Damasio's idea by a reviewer. Then Damasio himself says, the brain is constantly receiving signals from the body, registering our views on what's going on outside of us. These processes then create what's known as maps of the bodies or feelings, which are snapshots of our reactions to what's going on around us. So basically, before we have any views, we have a physical, unconscious, somatic response. And then on top of it, the brain creates all this explanation about why what's going on is good or bad, and tries to then figure out what to do to get rid of it. Sometimes what's going on is really bad. not simply because we've had a previous experience, but sometimes somebody really is acting like an idiot. Sometimes somebody really is violent or abusive or unsupportive, and that we really should review our relationship with them, whether they're safe to be around. But other times we have a negative view of people simply because something ancillary that has nothing to do with what they're doing objectively is triggering an unconscious emotional state that we're aware of. So where does practice come in here? The monks I've studied with talk about all the time bringing back the awareness again and again and again, away from all the thought stories that we build up around people that we don't like, or people that we do like, or jobs that we suddenly don't like, or events that we suddenly can't stand. And before we believe that there's something objectively wrong with what's being experienced, ask ourselves, what's going on inside of me that needs to be paid attention to? What can I be with and sit with and see what's going on beneath this suddenly strong view, this suddenly strong opinion, this suddenly this overwhelming need to get somebody out of my life, to get rid of an old friend or get rid of a job or get rid of a situation? What's going on here? To investigate it. Again, sometimes jobs and people really do fucking suck, right? I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. The Buddha had a word for sucky people, called Bellavaga. He said that there are sucky people. He didn't say that they can't change, but there are shitty people. But sometimes we suddenly get this desire to never see someone or avoid them or stay away. And we're not, and we come up with sometimes these awkward, or we're not sure, we just feel driven. And it's really worthwhile seeing what comprises this sudden need to change something fundamental about our life, to throw away a relationship. What's going on there? Very often, what happens if we sit with these vedana, this somatic state in the body, this unconscious response, and we just sit and we just ask, what's asking to be felt? What's asking to be for my awareness right now? What do I need to attend to? These are some of the questions I ask, and you can come up with your own. I just often ask, what does this feel like? Always again and again in any experience in life, I ask, what does this feel like? And often when I let go of the whole story in my head about why some, you know, event that I'm dreading is really going to suck, and I simply say, okay, what does this fear feel like? What's asking to be made aware of? And then I sit with it and I feel the feelings. Then occasionally what happens is an earlier, more true previous set of experiences will become available to me. I'll start to become aware that this is not contemporary. This feeling of dread about going to some Thanksgiving party, or, you know, having to go to a new job, or having to see somebody that I haven't seen for a long time, or whatever is the aversion in my life, I can investigate it, and then I can see, wow, it's really not often about this person. It's about this previous experience. I'll give you an example. I was teaching here several months ago, and there was, of course, the car horns and the truck horns, and there was one truck guy that must have gotten stuck in traffic right outside. It was really honking. And then he stopped honking. And I thought, oh, it was this release in the body. Then somebody came late and was, like, just like punishing me with the buzzer. It felt like they were punishing me. If you're late, I ask, just push it once. We'll hear. Pushing it 8 times will not get you buzzed in any quicker. So so that sort of New Yorker type neurosis that I have, I gotta get in. So the stimuli gave birth to this underlying feeling of aversion. You know, my peaceful meditation was being disrupted. And then what happened was, I unconsciously was aware of this aversion, and I started this whole story about how nobody anymore is patient. And then that story went to, I remembered the Dharma Punks retreats in Massachusetts that we had, and how quiet and how peaceful that was. And then that image, that story, then turned into a self view, which is Noah gets to teach retreats all the time. I get to teach one or two, you know, that's Noah's doing this all the time. It's unfair. Sure, he's famous and he came up with Dharma Punks, but I'm stuck here with car horns. So suddenly, then it became, I must really suck. You know? So the whole journey went from sensation of car and buzzer to discomfort to there's something wrong and unfair with the world to, you know, to there's something wrong with me. And that's the journey. The Buddha says we go from Vedana to Tanha, which is a state of wanting to change things or grab or clutch. Then we go to attachment, which is Upadana. Then we go to becoming, which is Bhavana. We go to immediately to how can I, you know, we make statements about ourselves. Another example was, I live in Williamsburg, which is sort of like the birthplace, it seems to me, of every single fashion trend known to man. You see it at its birth, and then, you know, 2 years later, everybody's wearing it. And so for about a year, I noticed that people were wearing these Indian prints. I finally found one. These nice Indian. Most of the trends I can't stand, but there was this Indian print sort of sweaters that people were wearing, and so I became obsessed with. I've got to get one of these because they look great, and that's the beginning of ignorance, which is I'm going to get rid of this feeling that I don't have and other people do have by getting a sweater. And so I went to Buffalo Exchange all the time because I don't have that much money to spend on, like, you know, something super expensive. So I was going to find this Indian print. Anyway, I went there one day and there it was. Right there. 20 feet in front of me. Unfortunately, 15 feet in front of me was somebody else who spotted it at the exact same time and reached and grabbed it and walked to the mirror with his friends. He was younger, and immediately my mind determined that I've been living here forever. These people come to my neighborhood and they steal my cardigan from under my nose. These posers, wannabe hipsters. Look at this fucking hipster posing in my Indian print cardigan. What's wrong with the world? So this underlying feeling of just first seeing a sweater that looked good on somebody turned into this want, which then turned into this whole agenda, which turned into this whole view of the world around me and how, you know, people who moved to my neighborhood sucked. And I realized this, and I'm like, what's going on here? And I just felt this, you know, physical craving. Very funny. The funniest thing, when you sit with physical craving and you sit long enough with physical aversion, is that they're incredibly similar. A girl I knew, a very insightful woman, she said to me that for years she had dated the worst guys for her imaginable because she had been mistaking her fear for lust. Whenever she'd see a guy and something about him would just trigger the uh-oh, stay away. There's something deeply wrong. And of course, you know, that have the normal fear response, which is the hair on the back of the neck, the heart would start beating, the sweaty skin, the contraction of the muscles. And her brain would go, seeing this state, I'm in love. I should be with this guy. So it's really interesting when we begin to sit, we both fear and craving, actually at the end of the day, they're both just physical responses saying something's going on. And then we add on top of it these stories often send us spiraling off into exactly the wrong place. How many people wind up eating the most deadly form of comfort food simply because at one point in their life, when they were younger, they felt in control when they could sneak into the kitchen and stuff themselves with, you know, crackers or, you know, whatever. And so we repeat this process, trying to create again the feeling of I'll be okay if I just consume this. We're not aware of the underlying physical stress that's driving this obsessive compulsive response. So finally, I'll conclude with, as I've been sitting and studying my own Vedana, my own felt responses to life, I've noticed that there's two kinds of feelings beyond just the negative and the positive. There's feelings in the body that are expressive of past traumas or past events. And these are upwardly moving feelings. They tend to want to, they're expansive. And they, very often I've found that people are very frightened of fear because fear is something that moves and expands and spreads. And fear is almost always historical. So old feelings are generally the ones that are asking for our awareness because they never received full attention. We always run away and try to get rid of body states and fears and stuff like that. So when we re-experience a fear, it's constantly feeling like it's moving up and taking us over. The same with, you know, worry and dread. They often start in my stomach and spread up to my chest and my shoulders. And they're simply asking for attention. But there's obviously this feeling with, there's this worry in the mind when fear arises that, oh no, it's going to take me over. It's never going to go away. I'm going to be consumed by this because it's spreading in the body. And then I found there's a second kind of Vedana, which is a reaction to the first, and it's a clamping down. It's a physical trying to contain and push away this original felt fear or worry or concern. And so this is often happening in my throat or my jaw. There's this downward, like, go away, a physical, oh no, I'm about to be taken over by fear. And so what happens is then there's this underlying war between old fears asking for my attention and then a second layer of physical, oh no, I can't give it my attention, I have to make this fear go away. And then on top of it, there's all the thinking and the thoughts about what's going wrong around me that must be the reason why I feel so uncomfortable. So it's a very entangled web that requires a lot of disentangling. And it always starts again and again with bringing the awareness back from what's ever going on around us, mindfully into the body, to see and ask again and again and again, what's asking to be felt here? What have I been running away from? What feeling state in the body do I not want to give space to and allow to be? So I hope there was something in there of some interest to you. I thank you so much for listening. And now is your opportunity to ask any questions about any part of the spiritual practice in your life or tonight's talk. So I'm going to turn this off.